You're listening to another top-rated radio show on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to the American Hour with your host, Commander Tom Garcia, on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Good evening, everybody. This is Commander Tom Garcia. Welcome to the American Hour, and this is on the USA Talk Radio Network. Thanks so much for joining us. And, of course, well, we've got a great guest today. He's going to be calling in a few minutes. Gary Ivey, author of the book Backlash, What Happens When Gas is $6 a Gallon. Interesting book, and I've been reading through it the last couple of days. It's a fictional account. We'll let him tell us what, you know, give us the synopsis, but it's about an oil rig that the terrorists hit, and the type of terrorists won't surprise you. They're not Middle Eastern terrorists, but in any case, before he calls in, Paul, a couple things to cover here. All right, well, we've got our guest here. It's time to get on with the best part of this show. Gary Ivey, who's recently written a book called Backlash, What Happens When Gas is $6 a Gallon. Gary, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. Listen, I talked just a little bit a few minutes ago about the book, but give us a synopsis about what the book is. And, of course, I told everybody it's a fictional piece of work, but it's something that – and include in your – give us a synopsis and what – pushed you to write this thing, because I'm guessing that you are looking at the situation that's been going on with oil companies and activists, et cetera, and you can see something like this happening. You know, I've been reading through your book the last couple of days, and this is something I could very likely see actually happening, even though it's a fictional account. But I think you're probably basing this on what's been going on in the last few years. So give us a synopsis and why you wrote this book.
Yeah, interestingly enough, it does seem very, very timely right now, but I actually started writing the book about 12 years ago. And the basic story is about a young woman who becomes the CEO of a large oil company, the largest gasoline retailer in the country. Her grandfather started the company. And she becomes the CEO when her father dies. And immediately, the company is hit with an environmental terrorist act. They blow up an offshore oil platform. And this leads to Congress taking action to put a $2 a gallon gas tax on gasoline, because they feel like the oil companies are making too much money, and what they do is fouling the environment, and all kinds of reasons. And so the book follows the process as this tax is enacted, which, in the fictional world of Backlash, there is already a $5 a gallon gas price cap on gasoline. And so this raises the cap to $6, but the tax is $2 a gallon. The Senate and the House of Representatives did that in order to punish the oil companies. And so when they enact the tax, the heroine of the book, whose name is Jackie James, she and her executives in the company come to realize that there's no way to make a profit on gasoline when the tax is purposely designed to take away a dollar from each gallon of gas they sell. They can't pass on one of those $2. So they launch Operation Backlash, which basically is just simply a moratorium where even though they're the largest gasoline retailer in the country, they decide that for 3 months, for one quarter, they will not sell any gasoline. And this is just their way of saying, you know, we are protesting this tax, and we're just not going to sell any gasoline. So the book follows what happens after that, and there are additional terrorist attacks by environmental extremists. And there is, of course, an investigation, and eventually people are brought to justice and so forth. But it follows closely the activities not just of Jackie James and the oil company, which is called Axiom Oil, but also the terrorists and the others in a fairly wide-ranging conspiracy to try basically to get a bunch of money from the oil companies to go into the government.
Well, you know, this is what we talk about on the show a lot, and that is that it's really about the government. The government's more important than anybody else in anything. Our elected officials keep making that clear. Nobody's talking about, and this is slightly off the subject, but nobody's talking about lowering your taxes, Gary, or lowering my taxes or Paula's taxes. They're just talking about raising somebody else's taxes. Well, if it's unfair that somebody else isn't paying as much as me, and that's the only case they've made. The only case they've made is that some of these rich people, in an effort, government's effort to ensure there's more money to be invested in all kinds of things, have kept capital gains and corporate tax rates lower. So that's always good for the economy. But now suddenly, oh, it's just not fair that people who have a lot of money and invest their money should pay lower taxes.
Well, yeah, interestingly, there was even a survey taken not too long ago where people were asked, would they rather make more money or have someone who makes more money than them lose some of that money in taxes? And a lot of them were more interested in seeing the people that make more money punished.
This goes to my monologue in the beginning. We have moved away from being a Christian and Judeo-Christian nation because the Tenth Commandment says, thou shalt not covet. And that's all that is. That's coveting. That is coveting.
That's exactly.
Every time people talk about this, I think if people were to reexamine their backgrounds, their lives, the way they were brought up, and go back to church if they're not going, or just simply reexamine the Bible and take a look at the Ten Commandments, they would realize this is not a Christian view. This is not a moral view. This is a violation of one of our most basic commandments as a Judeo-Christian society. So the other thing is
I
find it interesting.
We really ought
in your
to
book.
Rejoice. We really ought to rejoice when people prosper because that means they're being blessed, and that means that they can bless others.
Well, look, where are these people that are rich, like Mitt Romney, for example, that are investing and making, you know, a good return on their rate of investment? They're investing in pension plans of firefighters, of policemen, of private corporations. They're investing in venture capital groups. They're investing in education funds. Every state in this nation floats bonds to pay for state-run education, so particularly at the college level, but even at the elementary level. And investors are buying those bonds. It's not the government that's paying for this stuff. Government's paying for it by creating an investment. In other words, people invest in government. If you simply take their money via taxation, they don't have as much money to invest, so they're not going to invest as much money. And we've seen how the government is not so good at investing. The government is $15 trillion in debt, but rich people like Warren Buffett and Mitt Romney, they're not in any debt. So clearly the private sector is much better at investing than the government.
Yeah, I heard you talking about the president's remarks about silver spoons. I purposely made the central character of Backlash a very rich person. And in fact, I used the term she was born with the proverbial silver spoon in her mouth because I wanted to kind of give a look at someone who does have more than your average good fortune, but at the same time is very generous and cares about her employees and about the stockholders and about the people who depend on the products that the company produces. And I think that's important. I think that too often, and it's too easy to portray the rich people as abusive, and when that's really not true. I mean, it's true sometimes. Of course, something is always true in some cases. But you mentioned Mitt Romney. I like to say that when someone is wealthy, they have two things that they can do with their money. They can spend it, or they can save and invest it. And if they spend it, that means that the retail sales clerk and the truck driver and the warehouse person and the manufacturing line person, they all make money. If they invest it, then that means that you and I have an opportunity to go to a bank and borrow money to buy a home and fulfill the American dream. And, of course, you can go into a lot more detail with that. But that kind of thing is lost on a lot of people, and the class warfare that we see so often doesn't help a bit.
Yeah, oh, I agree. No, I really like that fact. That it caught my eye when I was reading that Jackie was, perceived to be born with a silver spoon in her mouth. And yes, she was born into a very rich family, big oil company, et cetera. I like that because I could tell right off the bat that she was a really hard worker and did care about her employees. Remember, well, I'm not going to say remember to you, but anybody that's read the book, if you haven't, you got to go get the book. Gary, tell us where your website is, where people can find out more about the book and find a way to purchase the book.
Well, I have a blog at garyivey.com, and it links over to the website for the book, which is backlashbook.com. And it's available on Amazon, and there's an EPUB version at Barnes & Noble, and iBook version is going to be ready soon, and going to be working on audiobook as well. So that's where it's available.
Excellent. Yeah, and so what I was saying about Jackie, I could tell right off the bat that she was somebody that was working hard, and before the explosion occurs on the oil rig, she had just been out there visiting the folks, and the folks liked her. The mm-hmm. workers on that rig, the hardworking blue-collar workers there, liked her and continued to like her and admired her, and that she had taken the role of her father and filled his shoes, even though she's, as you described, petite, but filled his shoes and was doing a great job. And this wasn't a case of like the Deepwater Horizon where cutting corners and incompetence had created a situation that was a dangerous situation, but rather it was an act of terrorism. And this is the thing that environmentalists have been doing for some time. I've watched them do things to the military. I was on the aircraft carrier, the USS Constellation, and I watched activists try boarding the ship, and you can't have somebody boarding the ship below, and we took action, while we're sitting there in port. And violating federal property, that's essentially what a carrier is, the taxpayers have paid for, and
yes.
putting lives at risk, their own lives and other lives at risk. And so this is not the way to go about making change, but I'm going to play a clip for you because the president recently was here in South Florida. He's on his big college campus trip now, where what does that do for our economy? What does that do to put people back to work? He's campaigning, and at taxpayers' expense. We're paying for all of these trips, but his little discussion about trickle-down prosperity, and it reminds me of Axiom Oil Company, because he tries to make the case for a beneficent CEO like Jackie, but at the same time, he makes this statement that is absolutely backwards on trickle-down or trickle-up prosperity, which he calls trickle-up. But let's take a look at it. It's about 30 seconds long. I played it last week, but I'm going to play it again because it's important to see the hypocrisy and ludicrousness of the statement. tells me this guy is not too bright, because it's just the stupidest statement I think I've ever heard him say. Here we go.
In this country, prosperity has never trickled down from the wealthy few. Prosperity has always come from the bottom up, from a strong and growing middle class.
Wow, what an idiot. Okay, here it comes. Here comes the ludicrousness.
That's why a CEO like Henry Ford made a point to pay his workers enough money so that they could buy the cars that they were building.
Wow, okay, so he paid them well. In other words, Henry Ford understood. Henry Ford made an economic decision that he was free to make, yes or no. That's maybe one of the reasons that Ford didn't need a bailout. That's one of the reasons that Ford has been a strong motor company all these years and has been very successful, because they had
I actually made that point in a blog recently talking about the Chevy Volt, because President Obama has encouraged the production of the Chevy Volt, and I'm not opposed to developing new sources of energy and new technologies, but when you have to pay people $7,500 or maybe now $10,000 to buy the car, you've got a problem right there, not to mention some of the other potential problems with the technology itself. And Henry Ford, I happened to mention in my blog, as it happens, he did not have a government program that enabled him to build his cars, and the automobile replaced the horse and buggy, not with a government program, but because the product was superior.
Yeah, so the president's making the point that prosperity trickles up to the rich. They get rich off of those of us working, except then he tells us that Henry Ford paid his people a good wage. Well, that's trickle down. He just said that
it doesn't
trickle down, it trickles up, but then he gives us an example of trickle down. And the companies that do take care of their employees and take care of their shareholders are the companies that prosper and are here. I've read numerous books, because I used to do consulting work in the risk management area, mostly safety, but also in corporate operations. And there are some Harvard professors that have written books and on and on. I've got a whole bookshelf of books on this subject. That the companies that are the most successful are the ones that take care of their customer, the shareholder, and the employee. So Obama's point is correct. Take care of the employee. They like working there. They work hard, and you have a great product. And Ford has proven that over these years. But it's not. It doesn't mean that the employees took care of the CEO, and certainly Henry Ford and his family are very, very wealthy. This is a perfect case of, and I don't really like the term trickle down, but a perfect case of somebody who has the ability to create a successful company and very wealthy doing it right, and this is capitalism. But when government steps in, as you mentioned with Chevy and the Chevy Volt, that's when things go awry, because government never picks the winners. It always forces organizations to become losers. It's just a matter of history. So in any case, well, let's get back to the book. And we don't want to reveal too much about the book, but when you started this 12 years ago, I mean, what was your motivation to write this book?
Well, I basically was looking at the way that government interacts with business. My wife and I are entrepreneurs. We have our own business. We this is actually the third or fourth business that we've had over time. And this one we started about 15 years ago, and it has gained some traction. And we've been able to expand, and we have about 10 employees working with us. And so it is a very personal thing for me from that standpoint. We actually have what I call a wall of shame in our office, where I have posted all of the government posters that we are required to post. And like I said, we have about 10 employees, and the posters occupy about 10 square feet of wall space. And I just laugh when I look at it. One of the things that that I think is funny is that we have an OSHA poster there, and it has the statement, we have gone blank days without a workplace accident. Well, our company is a website company, and so our people sit at computers all day. We don't have much in the way of heavy machinery and the potential for accidents. And so in that blank, I put the symbol for infinity. because we have gone in an infinite number of days without an accident. And, you know, I just have to laugh at it. But and I'm not as burdened by the regulations and so forth that the government does as larger companies are. Because we're small, we fall below the threshold of some of those regulations. But that was the kind of thing that I was thinking about, and I could have chosen any industry, but the oil industry, of course, is a favorite whipping boy, and the gasoline prices, that's something that affects everyone, and it affects them every day. And it was interesting, during some of the research that I was doing, I found, I just did a Google search for gasoline humor to try to find, you know, some things that were funny just as part of the research. And so, you know, finding things like the father says to his son, when I was growing up, I had to walk 5 miles to school, and the son says, so your family couldn't afford gasoline either, and things like that. But I also found a joke from Jay Leno from about 8 years ago during the Bush administration. And the joke was that gasoline in California had soared to $2 a gallon. And and of course, he followed that up by saying that we couldn't find the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, but apparently we can't find any oil either, because otherwise gasoline should be free. But anyway, I just thought that was ironic that now I'm not hearing as much gasoline price humor these days as we did back during the Bush administration, which I think is ironic. But also, it was natural for me to choose the oil industry because I grew up in Oklahoma City, and my maternal grandfather drove a tanker truck for Kerr McGee back during the Depression, when the farm wasn't producing enough for the family to live on. My father joined Standard Oil of Ohio in the Oklahoma City field office as an accountant before I was born. And he stayed with them for 31 years, half that time as an accountant and the other half as part of the land lease and legal department where he administered mineral rights leases for SOHIO, which is what Standard Oil of Ohio went by. And shortly after he retired, it was bought out by BP. So my mother and father, who are still alive, they get a check every month from BP, and BP pays for their medical insurance and so forth as part of his pension. And so, and along with that, my first savings account was with Penn Square Bank. I don't know if you remember, Penn Square Bank was the savings and loan in Oklahoma City that in the 70s made too many risky loans to oil speculators, to oil, well, I shouldn't say speculators, but to drillers, speculative loans, and they got overextended. And the bank, which, as I say, was the place where I had my first savings account when I was just a kid, also got my my student loans there for college. Penn Square Bank failed, and that was the start of the savings and loan crisis back when. And so I have kind of been in and around the oil business, although I haven't personally worked in it, but I've kind of been, steeped in it, you might say. I mean, growing up in Oklahoma City, the Capitol is there, the Capitol of the state. The Capitol building has oil wells on the Capitol lawn. It's just kind of, when you grow up there, you grow up with oil. And so it was just kind of natural.
Yeah. Well, nice. You know, we've got a good friend, Bella D'Angelo, who does a show on the USA Radio Network. And if anybody hasn't heard of Bella, go to the website, USA Radio Network, and you can get the link to her show. I was on it last week. Apollo was on it a couple weeks before that. And she's right up there in North Dakota in the thick of it with a consulting business, and she knows what's going on in the oil industry. Of course, Paula is a bit of an expert on wind power and some other green technologies, and those are all good things, but they're all good within, you know, the constraints of can they make money, and that's what we want them to do. Can they be self-sufficient? Because ethanol has been subsidized all these years, and we now know that ethanol pollutes more than gasoline. So, but Paula, any questions for Gary?
Right now, no, I'm sorry, I don't.
Okay. That's okay. That's okay.
Well, on that note, I wrote a blog again. It was happened to be a different one, but also about the Chevy Volt, in which I said I'm not opposed to developing these other technologies. I'm not saying by writing this book, I'm not saying that I believe that oil is the end all. I think that we definitely need an all of the above approach, because our energy needs, not just in this country but worldwide, are growing by leaps and bounds right now, and it's just not smart to limit ourselves. That's what I would say. And ironically, an electric car or a hybrid, which uses electricity to supplement gasoline power, electricity is generated, almost 50% of electricity is generated from coal. And so even if you're driving a hybrid, you're still in a 75% fossil fuel car. And that's a point I think that's lost on a lot of people, but I think it's an important thing to remember. And so I my philosophy is forward on all fronts. We're going to need it all, because with China beginning to be mobilized, for a long time they couldn't afford cars, but they can now. And that's a lot of cars.
Yeah. Hey, I was there in the 80s when China opened up and said, yes, visitors from outside China can come in. And believe it or not, some of the first visitors were those of us in the military that were visiting Hong Kong. And I was on the Constellation, USS Constellation, and we pulled into port and went into Hong Kong for a visit. And then we took a boat ride over to Macau, and normally, that's the only place you could go, which really wasn't representative of China, but they were now allowing people to come into China. So anybody with a passport, you had to have a passport, it makes sense. could go in. And so a group of us went in and got a tour of from, you know, the countryside to a village to a bigger village to a town to finally a city. And it was a small city. And the population of this, quote, small city was 2 million people. And back then, nobody could afford a car. The only vehicles you saw were commercial vehicles, and there weren't very many of them. But when you were in the city, the sidewalks were lined for as far as you could see on every single street with bicycles. And that's what they that's how they got around, bicycles, walking and bicycles. But now those bicycles are all gone, and they've all been replaced with cars. Now, Gary, did you get a chance to take a look at the gentleman, I can't remember his name now, but he wrote the book on oil being a renewable resource.
Yeah. Thomas Gold, the Deep Hot Biosphere is, the name of the book. I have not gotten all the way through the book, but I've read about the first three chapters. Fascinating stuff. I'm sure that that in the scientific community, he's looked at as somewhat of a heretic.
Right. But it all makes sense, and I've done a lot of research on some of the scientific aspects of it. I've got an engineering degree, and it doesn't mean I'm the smartest guy in the world, but I've looked at some specific aspects of it. I'm not finding anybody refuting what he's saying, and the fact that the Russians are drilling 40,000 feet down into the earth to get oil that is supposed to only exist in the first 3,000 feet. And you can say, well, it's seeping down, but yet we're finding hundreds of oil fields around the world that have been supposedly depleted that have been refilled, and in some cases producing more oil than they were before. So the oil, there clearly is oil coming up. And so his whole, and we're not going to get into it tonight because it's a bit technical. It takes a little while to explain it to everybody.
Yes.
But the beauty of this, oh, I love this, because anytime I talk with and you don't have to agree with me on this term, but libtard, I can't stand liberals. They just, they don't deal in facts, they only deal in emotion. And so I call them libtards. And I love telling libtards, well, what if it turns out that oil is renewable? That would make it green, wouldn't it? And it's not the evil product that you think it is. In fact, why is it evil? Explain to me why it's evil, because whatever we replace oil with, gasoline with, we're going to be dependent on that. We are a transportation society. We're going to be dependent on something. Even if it's algae, even if it's wind, even if it's solar, we're going to be dependent on that. We're always going to be dependent on something other than using our legs to walk or pedal a bicycle. So what is it that you, Mr. Lib or Mrs. Libtard, want to be dependent on? Well, they don't like that. Like, well, I don't want to be dependent on anything. Well, then you better stop driving your car. Because you're dependent on something. It doesn't matter what your car is burning. It doesn't matter if you're plugging in and using electricity. You're dependent. We're dependent on food. Mm-hmm. We're all dependent on food. If we stop eating food, we die. We're dependent on water. Stop drinking water, we die. It's not bad to be dependent on something. It's just a matter of what is the best way to sustain our dependencies. And if oil turns out to be renewable, and I'm telling you, I've done a lot of research on this. I'm amazed this hasn't gotten more publicity, and I believe he's absolutely right on this. There have been other things that he's been involved in science. You know, he's, technically an astronomer, astrophysics, something along those lines. And he's credited with some amazing inventions and discoveries and things like that. This is a smart, smart guy, not some quack that just came up with some idea. This guy is a true scientist that's credited with many great advances in science over his lifetime. And that's like saying Einstein. Einstein had nothing to do with the oil companies and gasoline and energy and renewable energy and all of that stuff. But if Albert Einstein said, I've got this theory that oil is not a fossil fuel, but it's coming up from the core of our planet. And I'll just throw this out to folks that if they haven't listened to the previous shows. How is it that we have hydrocarbons in the form of methane gas in massive quantities in Saturn and Jupiter if hydrocarbons only come from a, quote, fossil fuel, life? And to say that life existed at one time, well, life never existed on Jupiter and planet, but there could be microorganisms deep in the core of that planet. We do believe that there is moisture and ice crystals and on some of these planets. That means there could be water within the planet. So life could be sustained at the microorganism level, and that's what Thomas Gold is talking about, is necessary to create hydrocarbons within the core of any given planet, along with the actual structure, the rock structure that exists there, and it's renewable. I mean, it's just never ending. It'll just keep coming.
If his theory turns out to be correct, then it turns the entire geologic theory on its head, and the drilling that's being done 8,000 feet below the surface of the Gulf of Mexico, for instance, in some of the really deep water wells, if they're not, I don't know if they were included in the moratorium or not, but that's going down a long, long ways. But you mentioned 40,000 in Russia, and oil is lighter than rock. It doesn't go down, it goes up.
Right, yeah, exactly. And so the Russians figured this out back in the, I think it was the 40s, or I think the 40s, but they didn't have the technology. By the 70s, though, they were able to do it, and they're just pressing forward. I mean, we're giving them the rights to drill in the Arctic Ocean. I want somebody to tell me what kind of plant life and animal life is contributing to oil 8,000, 40,000 feet below the surface of the cold, frigid ocean. It's not. Decomposition of plant life, seaweeds, fish, et cetera, is not the same as it is on land. So how out in the middle of the Arctic Ocean, deep, deep down below, are we getting the kind of decomposition that exists on land? I mean, it doesn't make – and so the only way they can counter that is say, well, it occurred on land and seeped down there, or it occurred on land – first of all, when the land masses were all one big land mass and the continents divided and broke apart was so long ago, there was no significant plant and animal life back then. That was before anything significant actually existed. So all these theories are based on a theory that was put forth in 1870s, fossil
yes.
fuels. That's where it originated. So
yeah,
not
you
to say that there
the...
weren't smart people back then, but we know so
right.
much more about
right.
The history of this planet now, that just doesn't hold water anymore, and more people need to be discussing it. So
You mentioned the 1970s. I remember in the 1970s the first time I ever saw gasoline that was over $1 a gallon during the oil crisis of the 1970s. And at that time, we were told that we had 15 years' worth of oil left, and then it would all be
right.
gone.
Right,
yet we're still drilling and we're still finding new oil fields to drill in, and so that from that standpoint, the theory that the oil is being produced by other processes than we formerly believed sounds like it could be legitimate.
Exactly, and you know, this is where my tax dollars, our tax dollars, ought to be spent. On taking a look at this and analyzing it, instead of giving the Department of Energy $29 billion a year to squander on companies that continually go bankrupt and ideas that are bankrupt ideas, let's take a look at something that has some real science behind it and spend taxpayers' dollars to determine if this can be exploited. But no, the Department mm-hmm. of Energy that was formed under Jimmy Carter to reduce our dependence on foreign oil, that was its mission. If you go to their website now, they have a new mission, to reduce our use of oil.
Period.
I mean, that's just stupid. That's just absolutely stupid. We're squandering our tax dollars. And quite frankly, I think that entire department needs to be disbanded. $29 billion. That's what Obama asked for in his new budget. They've been at about $25 billion for several years now. And we're getting no return on our investment as taxpayers.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are several departments of the federal government that need to be revamped, if not eliminated, and of course the EPA is one of them. The Department of Energy is certainly another, And there may be valuable things for them to do. Certainly, there was a time when pollution was a problem, when other aspects of conservation were a serious problem. Growing up in Oklahoma, I know all about the Dust Bowl, for instance. You know, there are things that we do need to be concerned about. But it needs to be a concern with an awareness of the needs of people. When too many politicians talk about the oil business and the profits of the oil business and so forth, they give a picture of these wealthy tycoons, of the speculators and the Wall Street types, and that's. But that's not who I think of when I think of the oil business. When I think of the oil business, I think of my dad, who worked for 30 years as a low-level pool accountant, and, you know, retired with almost nothing. You know, they scraped and saved and sent me to college and so forth. But they were never wealthy, You know, the other people who work in that industry to provide a commodity that we all need and use every day, and yet they're maligned and criticized as if they're villains, and it's inconceivable to me. And so one of the things in my book is Jackie James is called before a Senate committee to, you know, give a reason for this Operation Backlash, and so that gives her an opportunity to tell the politicians how her company and her employees and her stockholders and her customers are all affected by the things that they do. And that's really the crux of the book, is what the government does affects people, individual people who are not wealthy, people who live their lives, who try to feed their kids and try, you know, go to work every day. These are the kinds of people that our president talks about, but he does things that maybe indirectly, but he does things that hurts them. When he tries to hurt the rich fat cats, but he's really hurting the people who are working hard, who are not wealthy, and who are just trying to feed their families and carry on their daily lives.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because, you know, you can raise the taxes. I found it very interesting in your book that the $2 a gallon tax. $1 has to be absorbed by the oil company, and they can't raise their prices to compensate for that. The bottom line is that all businesses roll their taxes into their bottom line. So businesses don't pay taxes. The consumer pays taxes. And this is the way that the liberals trick us into getting into our pocket and raising our taxes, the people's taxes, without raising our income tax. That's how they get to us, and that's what they're doing. So every time the president talks about going after big, bad, evil companies and raising their taxes, he's really saying, I want the middle class. I want the not middle class. I want everybody else paying higher taxes, but I'm not going to raise your income taxes. I'm just going to raise the price of everything that you pay for. That's how I'm going to get more money for the government.
Mm-hmm.
Well, listen, Gary.
Yeah, there are so many hidden taxes that it staggers the mind when you start thinking about it.
Absolutely. Well, tell everybody one more time where they can find you and your information, your blog site, as well as the link there, obviously, to your book. I know it's but go ahead. Tell us where they can connect.
It's just GaryIvey.com, and Ivy is Ivey. There's about four different ways to spell Ivy, but mine is Ivey, GaryIvey.com, and BacklashBook.com is the website for the book. And on Twitter, I'm at Gary_Ivey.
Awesome. Gary, thanks. It's been an absolute pleasure. We'll have to have you back again another time to talk about this stuff. It's really incredibly interesting. We're going to have to put a link up on the website a permanent link there to your website, because you do some great blogging and got some great information, and you are a true patriot. Thank you for your service, and thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it very much.
All right. Have a good night.
Thanks, Paula, Gary.
What do you think of that? That was a great interview. Man, I've been waiting all week for this interview because I just from reading Gary's stuff and reading his book, I knew that this was going to be a great interview. What a sharp guy, a smart guy, great book. I really enjoyed reading the book, and I've learned a lot in terms of, and now that I know that he started writing this book 12 years ago, my gosh, what great timing to come out with this book. Because it's, it really hits to the point of things that are going on today with the price of gas and drilling and what we really need to be focused on in terms of trying to solve our energy problems.
Right.
So anyway, well, listen, I want to do something, Paula, right now that we haven't done in the past.